Chapter 19, Meditating Among the Ruins. In Kalimpong, I had been accustomed to start the day with puja and meditation, rising at dawn for this purpose, and repairing to the shrine room as soon as I had drunk a cup of tea. For the first 6 or 7 years I had spent in the town, my principal practice was anapanasati, or respiration mindfulness, as it had been during my years of wandering. But from 1957 onwards, there was a change. In that year, and the years that immediately followed, I received from Chatral Sanjay Dorje and other leading Tibetan lamas, including Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and Duchom Rinpoche, a number of Vajrayana initiations, as a result of which an increasing amount of my time came to be devoted to such practices as deity yoga and the four foundation yogas, especially the going for refuge and prostration practice, centered upon the awe-inspiring figure of Padmasambhava. After my return to England, I soon found that my duties as head of the English Sangha and incumbent of the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara left me with as little time for personal meditation as for literary work. Not that I minded over much. For me, communicating the Dharma through the medium of the spoken word was an important spiritual practice, and one that sometimes left me, at the end of a lecture, in an exalted state of consciousness, from which it was not always easy to come down. Nonetheless, it was with a feeling akin to relief that one morning, towards the end of May, with Ruth and the Vihara's three musketeers for travelling companions, I left Euston for the first of the three meditation retreats I was to lead that summer for the benefit of members of the Sangha Association and other friends. The first and second of these retreats each lasted a week, while the third lasted a whole fortnight. All three were held at Biddulph Old Hall, the Sangha Trust's meditation centre on the Staffordshire-Cheshire border. I had last visited the place early in March, when the countryside was covered in snow. Now it was spring, and since spring not only, quote, comes slowly up this way, but stays later than it does in the south, the grounds of Old Hall were gay with clumps and banks of daffodils, the brilliant yellow of which contrasted admirably with the green of the turf and the grey of the ruins that once had been part of the original building. In India, I had occasionally given instruction in meditation to individuals, but I had not led a meditation retreat for a group of people before, so that the first thing I had to do on my arrival at Old Hall on that first day of the first of my summer meditation retreats was to decide what kind of programme we should follow. As the retreat and its two successors were billed as meditation retreats, the practice of meditation in the form of anapanasati and metta bhavana naturally had to predominate. But for obvious reasons, I did not want to adopt the so-called insight retreat type of format, which, with its 20 hours of so-called vipassana practice a day, combined with the complete lack of normal human communication, tended to reduce the retreatant to the alienated state I had observed on my very first visit to Biddulph. I therefore devised a more balanced, mixed type of programme. There were altogether 5 sessions of guided group meditation a day, 1 in the morning after breakfast, 3 in the afternoon after an early lunch, and 1 in the evening. The morning and evening sessions were preceded by the performance of the Sevenfold Puja, while for the first 4 days, the last afternoon meditation was followed by a session of the speaker's class, at which Ruth, Alf, Mike, and others spoke on different aspects of the Dharma. The atmosphere of the retreat is well conveyed in an article by Ruth that appeared in the Sangha Association's journal a few months later under the title Meditating Among the Ruins. Quote, "It is difficult to convey the atmosphere of complete relaxation and at the same time of complete alertness. We really lived every minute of these days in such harmony with everyone and everything around us as I had never experienced before. There was a constant two-way stream of understanding and friendship between the members of the group and simultaneously between teacher and pupils. And the animals were included too. The two Siamese cats, who used to be so wild and destructive during their short stay at the Hampstead Vihara that the neighbours complained bitterly, were now quite tame and part and parcel of the meditation family. Our week passed quietly and swiftly in the routine of Buddhist practice. The day started with the sounding of the gong at 6:30, and soon after breakfast, our group silently crept up the stairs leading to the Venerable Stavira's Tara room, where we always had our meditation. We were usually joined by Anna, who is staying at Biddulph all year round, practicing serious meditation, as well as helping the wardens in the running of the centre. At the weekend, Margaret managed to join us too, and even Douglas popped up from time to time, when neither the kitchen nor the garden was calling him. We always started and finished the day with puja, a little devotional Mahayana service, which included the taking of the three refuges and the five precepts. In the morning, we usually had just 1 hour of meditation on watching breathing. The rest was spent in walking quietly among the shrubs and bluebells in the extensive grounds of the centre, or studying. Early lunch, the last meal of the day, and then extensive meditation on watching breathing and loving kindness, with always 1 hour break after each hour of meditation. We could help ourselves to cups of tea, coffee, or soup in our own little pantry during our off time, and if the pangs of hunger were too strong, someone might even take a chunk of bread and a little cheese. There was no "you must not" uttered or written on notice boards, but instead it was left to each of us to decide how much of the monastic discipline he was willing to take. In the evenings in the great hall, under the supervision of our beloved Stavira, we had miniature speakers training classes where we lectured on practically all the schools of Buddhism. The staff happily joined us on these occasions, and once even a Buddhist couple from Manchester came along to listen in. This was so nice about Biddulph. All the people who came to work and meditate there were practicing Buddhists. End of quote. I had forgotten the bluebells and the Siamese cats, but I remember Ruth and the other retreatants creeping silently up the stairs to the tower room every morning after breakfast and meditating with me there. I had already meditated on my own earlier, having risen at dawn in order to do so. In between the day's sessions, I gave personal interviews, discussed repair and reconstruction work with a local builder, and tape-recorded the three refuges and five precepts in Pali for Douglas, the centre's youthful warden, who, though wary of me at first, he was a disciple of Ananda Bodhi, soon realised that I was not as bad as he and Margaret, his wife, had been led to believe. I also finished reading Rodney Collins' The Theory of Eternal Life and started on his Theory of Celestial Influence and on Ian Bleacho's The Egyptian Mysteries. After a few days of this peaceful routine, I felt almost as though I was back in Kalimpong in my secluded hillside monastery, where, during the rains residence, I would concentrate on meditation and study, see only my resident students and the occasional visitor, and go no further than the garden gate. When we were 4 days into the retreat, I received an unwelcome reminder of the existence of the outside world. There was a telephone call after breakfast from an agitated Morris, who told me, in his usual panicky fashion, that there was a crisis at the Vihara and that immediate action was required. On my contacting Victor, the young man who was about to join our little community, he assured me that all was well, and I therefore asked him to go and see Morris and try to sort things out. Later that morning, during the pre-lunch break, I telephoned our easily alarmed chairman, whom Victor had by that time seen. There had been no crisis. All that had happened, it transpired, was that there had been no bread for breakfast, and that Ratanasara, instead of sending his personal attendant out to buy a loaf, had used the fact that there was no bread as an excuse for making various complaints about the hardship and difficulty he was experiencing at the Vihara. I was so disgusted by his total lack of the spirit of renunciation that I could not forbear speaking about the matter to Mangalo, who was then at Biddulph, though not taking part in the retreat, and he agreed with me that when it came to spreading the Dharma in England, such worldly-minded Southeast Asian monks were useless. Nor was this the only time Ratanasara gave me cause to regret I had ever invited him to stay with us. On another occasion, I returned to the Vihara to find that, in my absence, he had run up a bill for £92 at the local delicatessen, a bill I had to pay. Small wonder that Victor, who was a shrewd judge of character, should have christened him King Rat. The fifth day of the retreat was a day of silence. There had been no talking during breaks from the third day, and instead of the speaker's class, there was an extra session of meditation. A very good atmosphere prevailed, and as I had no personal interviews and the weather was fine, I was able to spend some time strolling in the garden and grounds. The programme the following day, our last full day at Biddulph, was somewhat less demanding. We meditated as usual, but people could talk during the breaks, and in the evening there was a special Buddhist version of that old BBC favourite, The Brains Trust. I divided the retreatants into what I hoped were two evenly matched teams, which then took it in turns to ask and answer questions on the Dharma. The puja before the final meditation was more elaborate than usual. Next morning, when we had all meditated together for the last time, those of us who were returning to London left for Congleton Station. We had spent a week bathed in a special kind of atmosphere, and in the words with which Ruth concluded her article, quote, "This Biddulph atmosphere of calm and quiet happiness greatly deepened through our prolonged meditation, we carried away with us when we faced the turbulent waters of the outside world once more. For me, those waters, as I encountered them on my return to the Vihara that afternoon, were not so much turbulent as stagnant. It was evident that during my absence, the meeting room shrine, with its brass Buddha image, had been shamefully neglected. There were no candles, and the flowers in the vases were all withered. Having settled in and had a talk with Victor, I went for a walk over Hampstead Heath, taking Victor with me. As it was Saturday afternoon and the weather was fine, there were rather a lot of people about, a fact of which I was all the more conscious for being fresh from the silence and calm of the retreat. On the way back to the Vihara, I bought a packet of candles and some flowers, sadly reflecting, as I did so, that Ratanasara was mindful enough of food, but not, it seemed, at all mindful of the Buddha. The second retreat took place 4 weeks later, and apart from the fact that there was no speaker's class, it followed the same mixed type of programme that I had devised for its predecessor. This time I travelled up to Biddulph, not by train, but by car, and thus could pay a short visit to Lichfield, which, as the birthplace of Dr. Johnson, was, to me, an important place of literary pilgrimage. I had become an ardent Johnsonian at an early age, after borrowing Birkbeck Hill's six-volume edition of Boswell's Life from the Tooting Public Library, and in the course of the next few years managed to read practically everything the great lexicographer had written. Even in India I did not neglect his works completely, and once back in England had returned to them with renewed zest. It was therefore with great delight that, after visiting the fine old cathedral, I explored the four-story corner house, now a museum, where Johnson had spent the first 18 years of his existence, and which contained many interesting relics of his life and work. Before leaving, I purchased a brass paper knife as a souvenir, the handle of the knife being in the form of the bewigged head of the doctor. The souvenir lies beside me on my desk as I write. Since purchasing it, I have visited Lichfield more than once and seen the corner house on the market square turn from a rather shabby museum into a smart information centre, and from an information centre back into a well-maintained museum, complete with comprehensive Johnsonian bookshop. I have also seen, seated high above the awnings of the market stalls and facing the birthplace, the massive, brooding figure of Johnson, which I do not recollect having seen on my original visit. Partly because of the weather, which was inclement for the time of year, in comparison with the first retreat, the second was a little dull, though with two people at least I had some interesting discussions, one of them being on Jung's psychology, with particular reference to the anima and animus archetypes. As before, the penultimate full day of the retreat was peak day, as I called it, with silence being observed practically the whole time. For me, the silence and the peace was broken by Mangalo, who, having returned earlier in the day from a trip to London, came to see me that evening, full of the gossip and backbiting he had heard there. Ratanasara, he said, had not only asked him to cooperate in ousting me, he had also told him that Alf Weil ought not to be a member of the Sangha Trust, as he was a Mahayana Buddhist. It was the last straw. Such interference was not to be tolerated. On my return to London, I discussed the situation with Morris and with Alf, and a few days later, at the same stormy meeting at which it rescinded its support for the London Buddhist College, the Trust decided that Ratanasara should be asked to leave the Vihara. The following afternoon, I had a frank talk with him and communicated the Trust's decision, for which he apparently had been prepared by a Stepien. According to my diary, it was interesting to observe his change of tactics. What those tactics were, I have long since forgotten, but all ended well, and he swore eternal friendship, and I was pleased and relieved at the way things had turned out. The third and last of the three summer meditation retreats was, in point of fact, two separate retreats, even though a few people from the first retreat had stayed on and joined the second. Among those who stayed on was Anna Phillips, who, as Ruth mentioned in her article, was living at Biddulph all the year round. With characteristic impulsiveness, Anna had plunged into Buddhism at the deep end. Not satisfied with attending all my lectures and classes, and being a member of the Sangha Association Committee and secretary of the Friends of the Triyanavardhana Vihara, she had persuaded her trustees to allow her to sink what remained of her capital in the purchase of a terrace property in Camden Town, where she would live and create a Buddhist community. She had also asked me to ordain her as a lay sister, and I had agreed to do so, on condition that she spent a year at Biddulph, deepening her experience of meditation and studying the Dharma. This she was now doing, and the ordination ceremony was due to take place on the peak day of the second of the 2 weeks that, between them, comprised the last summer meditation retreat. Part of my time during the first week was therefore spent going through the stages of the ceremony with her, impressing upon her the significance of the steps she was taking, as well as in giving meditation interviews to her and the other retreatants, among whom there were several who had not been to Biddulph before. Terry was one of these. Though entitled to 3 weeks' summer holiday, he had already made arrangements to spend the second and third of those weeks with Vivian in the south of Spain, where they in fact went every year, driving down in the little bus and camping. However, he was free to devote the first week to Biddulph and meditation, and we both had been looking forward to a longer period of continuous personal contact than it had so far been possible for us to have. We drove up to Old Hall via Coventry, where neither of us was impressed by the new cathedral, and that evening, after the guided group meditation, I took him through the visualization and mantra recitation practice centered upon the figure of Vajrasattva, the embodiment of primordial purity. In this practice, the meditator imagines a stream of milk-white nectar falling from the heart of Vajrasattva upon the crown of his head, whence it descends through the median nerve, permeating his entire being, and washing away all the defiling passions that obscure the innate purity and radiance of the mind. Terry already thought of his spiritual life in these terms. As a result of his ether abreaction, he had realized that the truth, pure and unadulterated, could be experienced here and now, and that for him, as he had told Dr. Capel, the best psychotherapy was a prolonged and sincere attempt to dispel the clouds that obscured the pure light of the mind. In the philosophy of Buddhism, he had found a context within which, he thought, it would be possible for him to make that attempt, and I judge that the spiritual practice which would enable him to do this in the most direct and effective manner was the one centered upon the figure of Vajrasattva. We did the practice every morning before breakfast together, and in the afternoon Terry did it alone in his room while I talked with some of the other retreatants, one of whom, a young man who had been coming regularly to the Vihara for the last few months, wanted to become a Shramanera, or novice monk, under my direction. The fact that Terry and I were doing the Vajrasattva practice together, as well as meditating for 5 or 6 hours a day with everyone else, gave to our friendship a new dimension and created between us a field of spiritual energy that was almost tangible. It was as though within the lake of silence and stillness that was the retreat, that is, the retreat at its best, there was a charmed area of intenser silence and more vibrant stillness that we alone occupied. In these circumstances, communication between us naturally deepened. Besides a mysterious mutual revelation of loneliness, there were exchanges my diary, in its usual laconic fashion, characterizes as being respectively profound and poignant, intense, and serious and important. There are also a few references of a more specific nature, references to a discussion on affinity, arising out of notes Terry had made earlier in the day. He was an inveterate maker of notes and filler-up of notebooks, to a talk we had about his daughter Fiona, and to a long walk in the course of which we touched on deepest themes. One of those themes was his ether abreaction, and I think it was only then that I fully appreciated the effect the experience had had on him, and the extent to which it determined the way he thought about himself and about the spiritual life. By the end of the week, I was not only well satisfied with the progress of our friendship, but felt I understood Terry better than before. I also realized that there was a qualitative difference, so to speak, between him and the rest of the people on the retreat, genuine as their interest in Buddhism and meditation may have been, up to a point. Victor and certain of the other young men, not excluding the one who wanted to become a novice monk, were capable of behaving, on occasion, in a crude and insensitive fashion. But Terry was invariably mindful, invariably well-mannered, and invariably sensitive to the feelings of others, besides being possessed of a depth of seriousness which they entirely lacked. On the last day of the retreat, Terry and I slipped out after the evening puja and meditation and drove to Rudyard Lake. Having walked round it and explored the picturesque countryside nearby, we found a quiet spot at the edge of a field and there passed the night in the little bus. The weather next day was exceptionally fine, and it was with reluctance that, around noon, we returned to Biddulph, having spent the morning in serious talk. Before leaving the place, we said our goodbyes, in case we should not be able to do so in private at the meditation centre, and I hung my rosary round Terry's neck and asked him to wear it while he was away. We both were much affected by the thought of our impending separation. After lunch, I saw Terry and others off, and a little later found myself being taken by a bubble car to Manchester, where I met the members of the Manchester Buddhist Society at the home of Connie Waterton, the secretary of the group, and gave a public lecture in a hired hall. Having stayed up late several nights running, I was feeling extremely tired, even after 2 or 3 cups of tea. But an energy from deep within came to my rescue, and the lecture, which was on Tibetan Buddhism, was pronounced a great success.